eradicating this terrorist group from the country.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The fist bump was the least of it, says Phyllis Penny's author in an article published under the heading, "The fist bump was bad, but Biden's West Asia policies are worse." Stay tuned for the details, please. President Biden's fist bump with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the president's up-close and personal handshake with former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sparked outrage and cries of hypocrisy from human rights activists, supporters of Palestinian rights, and defenders of democracy. MBS is, after all, responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the war that has devastated Yemenis. Netanyahu, currently on trial for multiple corruption charges, presided for a dozen years over Israeli regime's apartheid system, settlement expansion, war crimes in Gaza, and the murders of several journalists even before Shirin Abu Akleh was killed in May. Outrage was absolutely called for. Symbolism is important, but the fist bump and the handshake were the least of it. Biden's first presidential trip to the West Asia region had a lot to do with consolidating U.S. power and countering Chinese and Russian influence there, strengthening the Israeli and Saudi-led coalition under U.S. leadership and increasing arms sales. The timing had a lot to do with the war in Ukraine and the price of oil at home, with global shortages and price hikes linked to the war-driven sanctions against Russian crude. Biden's trip had a message for all of that. MBS and the Zionist leadership have been eager to reaffirm their tight partnerships with the U.S., following their strategically consistent but symbolically extreme embrace by Trump. Biden's greetings made clear that consistency was indeed his agenda, and that apartheid, war crimes, and murder of journalists would pose no barriers to those special ties between Washington and its favored West Asia allies. But far more consequential were the actions, what Biden did and didn't do during his meetings. He did reaffirm the strategic ties with both Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, making clear that human rights concerns, even if mentioned, would have no impact on actual relations and, crucially, no impact on billions of dollars in military aid and arms sales. He did reiterate the pride of place that both the Israeli regime and Saudi Arabia hold in the U.S. government's West Asia policy, their bilateral ties with Washington and their no longer secret ties with each other remain at the center of the U.S. strategy to continue as the dominant global power in the region. The president did say the right words, that human rights matter, that he believes Mohammed bin Salman is indeed responsible for the murder of Khashoggi, and that he still supports equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy for Palestinians and Israelis. But what didn't Biden do? He did not condition military sales to Saudi Arabia on ending the war against Yemen, despite the Arms Export Control Act's requirement that U.S.-provided arms be used for internal security or for legitimate self-defense. Like all his predecessors, he did not demand that U.S. military aid be conditioned on the Israeli regime, ending any of its specific human rights violations that keep equality but out of reach for Palestinians. He did not announce plans to cut that military assistance, even though the Leahy Law prohibits aid to any military unit that has committed a gross violation of human rights. And the U.S. admits the Israeli regime military was likely responsible for killing Shirin Abu Aghalé. Despite his public assertions about human rights, Biden did not announce or make any moves to actually hold either of these key U.S. allies to account for their violations. When Biden chose Saudi Arabia for his first visit to the region as president, the regime was thrilled seeing the trip as a chance to reclaim its primacy as Washington's favorite Arab country. What MBS wanted was indeed primarily symbolic, a handshake, or in this case, the notorious fist bump, a globally televised reminder of his stature meeting the U.S. president was an equal. He wanted the return to normal optics for U.S.-Saudi ties after Biden's campaign pledged to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. The crown prince got all that, but he also wanted some other things way beyond the symbolic level. He wanted continued arms deals, U.S. backing for Saudi Arabia's military dominance as the top U.S. proxy in the Arab world, and a clear grant of impunity for human rights violations, whether war crimes against Yemeni civilians or the assassination of a U.S. resident journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And he got all that too. Biden claimed he pushed back, telling MBS directly that he believed the prince was responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Then he left it there and turned to business as usual. He could have gone on to say, "And because we hold you responsible for that murder, and because you are largely responsible for the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world today, the war in Yemen, we are not selling you any more arms until there is some kind of real accountability." In fact, Biden said nothing of the kind. His only apparent request not made publicly was for Riyadh to increase oil production levels to help replace Russian oil and lower global and U.S. fuel prices. What if, rather than urging more oil production, Biden had told MBS that the U.S. instead planned to help provide Europe with massive economic support for a fast transition to sustainable energy to replace its dependence on fossil fuels? And it turns out Saudi Arabia has just doubled its imports of cheap Russian oil at sanctions-reduced rates for domestic use, so it can sell its own crude on the global market at today's sky-high market prices. Overall, the joint declaration celebrates the unshakable U.S. commitment to Israeli regime security. It includes Washington's guarantee of the Zionist regime's qualitative military edge and pledges to preserve and strengthen Israeli regime's capability to deter its enemies and to defend itself against any threat or combination of threats, as they say. And the declaration even promises more military aid beyond the current level of $3.8 billion every year. While that commitment is not so unusual, the declaration then adds something not so commonly found in diplomatic documents: the claim that all those U.S. commitments are sacrosanct. That's a word rarely used to describe political positions. Merriam-Webster defines sacrosanct as holy or immune from criticism. Given the criticism from human rights defenders, Palestinian rights organizers, and anti-war activists that has followed Biden's trip to the region, the notion that continuing U.S. military aid and protection of Israeli regime apartheid will somehow remain immune from criticism seems like wishful thinking on the part of the White House. There were other points of clear agreement. Biden and his Israeli counterparts signed off on an attack on the Palestinian-led BDS, that is, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, promising to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israeli regime, and to protect this regime at the United Nations and the International Criminal Court. And they agreed to allow all Israelis to enter the United States under the supposedly reciprocal visa waiver program, despite the Zionist regime's refusal to allow all U.S. citizens the same privilege. In fact, the U.S. State Department's own advisory warns that U.S. citizens of Arab or Muslim heritage, including Palestinian Americans, have experienced significant difficulties and unequal and occasionally hostile treatment at the occupied territories, borders, and checkpoints by Israelis. In 2017, Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia, where he signed an arms deal worth billions. In 2018, he announced a set of new U.S. policies towards the Zionist regime, moving the embassy to Al-Quds, recognizing Israel's annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights, and declaring the Jews-only settlements across the West Bank and East Al-Quds to be legal. Biden didn't ever agree with the Trump administration's position on the Israeli regime, and he called Saudi Arabia a pariah. He could have reversed Trump's policies on day one in the White House. But now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The first bump was the least of it. Economic divide.
The weaponization of water. Turkey flexes its muscles over Syria and Iraq. Is Turkey actually doing that? Well, Syrians and Iraqis think so. More importantly, they are saying that they're suffering immensely as a result of this. But why is Turkey cutting off the water supplies from the important Euphrates and Tigris rivers? That is what we're going to try to find out in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, water crisis that has been ongoing for quite some time. The Euphrates and Tigris rivers are the source of the conflict. Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. What types of tensions will erupt out of that is the key question. Then, the accusation leveled against Turkey, which is using water as a weapon. Is Turkey weaponizing water? Why would it do that? Is it trying to project power? And what is the statement from Turkey a while ago where it said water for oil in terms of a swap with the Persian Gulf countries? We're going to take a close look at that. Also, the dangers of war over water. Water scarcity, in which people may go and have an uprising because of their situation. Water diplomacy is the only way to go about that.
The water crisis is now a global problem, affecting not only West Asia, but also traditionally water-rich regions like Europe and West China. The crisis is mainly attributed to climate change and global warming, but when it comes to Syria and Iraq, one critical factor should be taken into account: Turkey's increasing involvement in manipulating the region's rivers and water resources. The current crisis has a long history of political geostrategic interests, alliances, and enmities. The main cause of the current mess and water dispute between Turkey and Syria stems from the crisis that prevailed after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the emergence of modern Turkey. Back then, Ankara was told by Allied powers to consult with Iraq and Syria over the hydraulic works.
When it comes to the issue of water, we are not out to actually accuse Turkey of being guilty on this. We are exploring and we're looking at the different ways as to why Turkey has been leveled this accusation. And that is the approach that we used actually to go after online posts on this, which hopefully sheds light about what people think about this. For example, post had this to say: Turkish fascist state continues to use water as a weapon against Syria. So that's one view, a negative view on Turkey. Next, Syrian parliament said that it had sent 57 letters to international and Arab organizations and parliaments calling them to condemn Turkey's ongoing water cutoff to Syria's Hasaka. And our final post on this issue: Turkey's southeastern Anatolia irrigation project, for example, is a series of 22 dams that diverts much of the Euphrates and it will leave Iraq with less than 50% of the water that it historically got, says Azam Awash, who's the director of Nature of Iraq. So those were some of the views, pretty much one-sided in this case. Let's find out if our guests are in that camp or the opposite camp. All right, those were some of the online posts on this. Actually, they were quite one-sided in terms of the way they viewed Turkey. Let's find out what our guests think. Let me introduce our first guest. Erman Çetin joins us. He's an investigative journalist and a researcher who actually is the author of the article from thecradle.com titled "The Weaponization of Water, Turkey Flexes Its Muscles Over Syria and Iraq." Erman Çetin, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what Turkey is doing, and based on what you have written in your article, you've accused them or it of flexing its muscles over Syria and Iraq. You talk about the Euphrates, which is the source of the current and future conflicts, as you have described, between Turkey and its neighbors, and how Ankara actually wants to project its power in the region. I mean, explain to us if really Turkey is guilty of that, because there are some who obviously reject that. Turkey obviously is one of them. And basically, has Turkey weaponized water for its political objectives? And what can those objectives be?
Yes, Turkey has rejected the allegations about it has been using the Euphrates and Tigris rivers for decades against its neighbors such as Iraq and Syria. It claimed that if Damascus does not cut their relationship with the PKK, the Turkish government could and would cut the Euphrates River's water, so Syria will be damaged. And there has been also lots of evidence about Turkish politicians' claims about Iraqi collusion between the PKK. The real question is for Turkey, those governments, those countries, Iraq and Syria, have been harboring the PKK, and they use the river, the water issue, as a threat against those countries.
All right, that's what the author of this article thinks. Mr. Erman Çetin, let's bring in Arara Sotimano. Arara Sotimano is a political scientist and a senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the School of International Relations, also a lecturer at the Faculty of Political Science, International Studies University, UNINT, who joins us from Torino, Italy. Welcome, Arara. Turkey is accused of claiming that it is actually using water for its own benefit by controlling the waters of the Euphrates and the Tigris at the expense of Iraq and Syria. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that Turkey is using that to exert power, where at the same time it has also been accused of disposing industrial and municipal waste into the water? What are Turkey's gains by doing this to Syria and Iraq, do you think?
Yes. About pollution, I think that in generally speaking, pollution is a more of a sort of a technical problem, in the sense that because of the scarcity of water, low levels of water means that the concentration of chemicals, of organic waste, of whatever pollutant there is higher in the water. So I don't see Turkey purposely, you know, trying to poison water going down to Syria and Iraq. This said, of course, Turkey is using water for agricultural purposes primarily. And the use of agricultural watering means that clean water is taken from the Euphrates into the Ataturk basin and other basins, used for agriculture, and then the reflux, the flow, is taken back into the Euphrates and back into Syria, remains, which is already polluted by agricultural fertilizers and these kind of things within Turkey.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program. This is where we review economic news from around the world. Well, this piece of news was somewhat devastating, though it wasn't presented that way, but the outcome will be. And it's all about the Russian oil prices and how there's a cap on it now. The G7 has unveiled that plan to enforce this Russian oil price cap. Now, Russia will not sell its oil at those prices, which brings about the question, will Europe's economy take more of a beating? Well, that should be a natural outcome. Has Europe thought about that? Only time will tell. On to our next story, India's economy. Let's find out how it is. This piece of news said that it has grown by 13.5%. That's right, 13.5%. And at the same time, the news says it has missed its target. Well, the jump came because of the low base of the previous quarter. And as a result of that, economists have cautioned that there's actually going to be a slowdown. But 13.5%, that's a great increase, don't you think? All right, on to our next story. The UK is in the news these days quite a bit in terms of its economy, but it has taken a double whammy. The UK energy price cap has now tripled, and the price of gas, as a result, roughly by 266%, it has increased in the past 12 months. Add to that soaring inflation, energy costs will leave millions who are going to live without basic dignity. That's how this piece of news was actually covered. So it'll be interesting to see how this is going to pan out. I mean, without immediate government action, basically 12 million households will be hit by fuel poverty in the UK this winter. 42% of all households in the UK is what that translates to, or 28 million people. Our final piece of news regards the Iran JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions relief talks. And this piece of news said, no, Iranians are not negotiating from a weak economic position. In fact, it said its economy grew 4.3% last year, which then calls into question, for example, the U.S.'s hawk's view that maximum pressure is beating Tehran into submission. Those were the news that we picked for you.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It is time now for our in-depth section. Water is scarce in the West Asia region. Water is scarce actually around the world. Anyways, Turkey knows that, and there are question marks around how it is handling water resources when it comes to rivers like the Tigris and the Euphrates, not to mention the massive dams that it has built around the Tigris in particular. Okay, first let's take a look at what is going on. Now, the source of the problem. The Euphrates-Tigris basin is shared between Turkey, Syria and Iraq, with Iran comprising parts of the Tigris basin. But the dams that Turkey has built, it has given Turkey, as an effect, the leverage to control the water flow, meaning that it can limit the volume of water that comes flowing through these dams. Okay? So that sets the scenario. Moving on, as such, in addition to Turkey's moves there, Syria is experiencing not only climate change, which is resulting in a drought, but also because of Turkey's dam building. 5 million people are suffering. So you have that occurring, the impact of what Turkey is doing, along with climate change. Two of Syria's dams are facing closures, which are responsible for generating electricity for 3 million people. Next up, we move on to Iraq. Iraq, as a result of what Turkey is doing, is not in good shape either. Actually, the drought there, again, as a result of climate change, along with Turkey's move, has impacted 7 million Iraqis. They are suffering as a result. So combine that with Syria, you have 12 million people whose lives are at risk. Next, some of the areas which has been affected in terms of the sectors include the following: farmland, obviously agriculture, fisheries, power production, and of course, drinking water. Now, how can people survive in these conditions? Now, meanwhile, Turkey is sitting pretty well when it comes to its water resources. When it comes to the percent originating from within its borders, it's 98%, but outside of its borders, in terms of the water, it only is in need of 1.5%. Now, by comparison, take a look at Syria. Originating outside of its borders for water that it needs, it's 72% reliant, while within it's 28%. And our last graph is Iraq, where you have 61% originating outside of its borders, while 39% Iraq relies on inside its border. All right, let's get a breakdown. Rejoining us is Armen Cheta, the investigative journalist and researcher, whom we told you is the author of the article from thecradle.com, Weaponization of Water. Armen, welcome back. When we take a look at what Turkey has done in terms of its intentions, there are geopolitical goals that obviously it has in mind. One of them is weakening the Syrian government in this case. What do you think is going on there, especially in comparison or in the same context of Israel, who is after weakening the Syrian government when it comes to, for example, water?
The Israeli government also supports the instabilization of Syria. It has invaded it in 1967, and it also annexed some part of Golan Heights. So also the Syrian people cannot use and cannot claim its sovereignty on the natural resources of the Golan Heights. And the Golan Heights is very rich with respect to natural resources. So what Israel want or has been wanted for decades on Syria is also, or not just Syria, the whole Arab land, the whole Palestine, is to claim its occupation on the Arabs' natural resources. So it's a part of Zionist strategy to weaken the Arab governments, the Arab countries, and Syria is one of the most respected supporters of the resistance against Zionist occupation.
All right, so let's find out what Aurora Sati Mano thinks. She's the political scientist and senior fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies, who rejoins us. Aurora, welcome back. Taking a look at Turkey, we have talked about how it is flexing its muscles, so to speak, when it comes to the way that it's using water as a weapon, as many have accused Turkey of doing. Is that the case? How is it affecting countries like Iraq and Syria, for example, which in this case in point are suffering as a result of water shortages? Is it only because of Turkey and what it's doing vis-a-vis the dams that it has constructed, for example?
Yes, definitely I would say that water is the source of conflict now, and it will be in the future, maybe even more. It has been in the past. So Turkey has tried to impose its will over hostile groups in northern Syria by, you know, manipulating water. And Turkey is also using its control of water to put pressure on the Assad government in order to accede to his vision, to Erdogan's vision of northern Syria. But to answer more properly, we should take a step back and look at historically. In the past, water policies have been always enmeshed with other political confrontations from the beginning of the GAP, the Great Anatolian Project, which consisted of, I think, 21 dams on the Euphrates and one on the Tigris. So since the 70s and during the 80s and 90s, links between water negotiation and politics, higher politics, regional relations, have been unmistakable.
Turkey has rejected the claim that it's using water as a weapon, and it says that it's working with Syria, Iraq, and Iran for the fair distribution of water resources. However, evidence suggests otherwise. A 2002 fact-finding mission said that Turkey was providing 300 cubic meters per second from Jarablus River instead of 500 cubic meters that was originally agreed upon. It is now predicted that the West Asia region is likely to witness more water-related crises in the near future, and Turkey's ambitious plans to monopolize water resources will give it a strategic weapon against its rivals and neighbors.
The issue of water in any part of the world is crucial for survival, but in the West Asia region, it is a matter of life and death. Turkey knows this, and the verdict is out on whether it is using it as a political tool or not. Many have concluded that it is. Turkey's position on the Euphrates and the Tigris is that these rivers are transboundary, means that they are rivers that cross at least one political border. Therefore, Ankara sees the two rivers as a uniform basin and part of its sovereignty. Iraq and Syria, however, see the rivers as international and separate entities. It's no surprise that this difference in the point of views needed a mediator to solve the conflict. This happened in 1980. After a joint security agreement with Syria, Turkey said any commitment by Turkey would be conditional to Syria's loyalty to the agreement. But then things hit a snag when Turkey threatened Damascus with severing its access to the Euphrates. The reason? Turkey's perceived notion of Damascus' support for PKK, which Ankara views as a terrorist organization. Turkey issued a statement soon after saying that Turkey's resources are Turkey's. The oil resources are theirs. We do not say we share their oil resources, and they cannot say they share our water resources. To make matters worse, Turkey was accused of environmental damage when it decided to take things a step further in this dispute. Turkey was accused of dumping industrial and municipal waste into rivers, hurting Iraqis and Syrians as a result, hurting things like irrigation use. Last but not least, there may be another reason why Turkey is keen on using water resources as a political tool against Syria. For that to be understood, we need to go as far back as the year 2004. Israel and Turkey signed an agreement whereby Turkey would sell water off the Manavgat River to Israel. The sale of Turkish water to Israel, however, failed. The recent improvement in diplomatic ties between Israel and Turkey gives rise to the possibility that since their interests converge in Syria, there may be reason for both wanting to keep the Syrian government weak. There's no credible evidence, however, to prove this theory. That does it for this segment of the program.
This is the situation when it comes to this water conflict. In West Asia, the water conflict has occurred when downstream countries are weak and unable to adapt to water scarcity, and where the relative strength is extremely low at this point for them to retain the water. The only solution that exists is for diplomacy to prevail. Some call it water diplomacy, which would involve Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Turkey once had the motto, zero problems with neighbors. It's time that it acts on that regarding this issue. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikhail Tagway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
With the death of Queen Elizabeth, criticisms of her legacy and hatred of former British colonies from violence, theft and cruelty of British colonialism were revived. Also, with the death of the Queen Elizabeth, many politicians and activists from former British colonies in the Caribbean want to remove this British royal from the head of their countries and demand compensation from Britain for slavery. For example, many Indians say that the British monarchs, and especially Elizabeth, are the cause of historical chaos in their country. Most interesting of all, there are significant negative reactions among the British people towards Elizabeth. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Africa News Channel said the death of the UK's longest reigning monarch and the subsequent coronation of her successor has rekindled the long-running debate about colonialism and how the British monarchy spawned systems of oppression and slavery worldwide. Queen Elizabeth's death on Thursday, September 8, revived the British monarchy's colonial legacy, with people across the world seeing her as a symbol of an institution that thrived through violence, oppression, and theft. At its height, about a century ago, Britain was the largest colonial power, with its monarchy holding sway over 412 million people, or nearly one-fourth of the world population, in different corners of the globe, from South Asia to Africa. Queen Elizabeth, who ruled over the UK for 7 decades, died at the age of 96. With the accession of King Charles III to the throne, it remains to be seen whether he will enjoy the same clout as his mother, as the leader of the UK and the head of the state of 14 other countries, including Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. The succession of Charles has prompted strong reactions from politicians and activists in former British colonies in the Caribbean who have called for the abolition of the British monarchy. Niambi Hall Campbell, an academic who chairs the Bahamas National Reparations Committee, was quoted as saying by Reuters on Thursday, September 8, "As the role of the monarchy changes, we expect this can be an opportunity to advance discussions of reparations for our region." David Denny, General Secretary of the Caribbean Movement for Peace and Integration, was quoted as saying, "Whoever will take over the position should be asked to allow the royal family to pay African people reparations," adding, "We should all work towards removing the royal family as head of state of our nations." Last year, Barbados, one of a dozen Caribbean nations, which are Commonwealth members, ditched the British monarch as the head of the state. The British daily The Guardian wrote, "The death of Queen Elizabeth II revived long-standing criticism in the US over the monarchy's enrichment from the British Empire's violent colonization of African, Asian, and Caribbean nations and their diasporas. Since her death on Thursday, September 8, American commentators, academics, and a former U.S. diplomat, among others, took to social media and elsewhere to call for fully wrestling with the British monarchy's lasting influence in light of the monarch's death. Many people across the world saw the Queen's passing as a bitter reminder of the British Empire's violent exploitation of countries throughout history, resulting in decades of suffering, death, and economic and social devastation, and a time to renew calls for reparations." Harvard University history professor Maya Jassen wrote in the New York Times, "Months after Elizabeth learned of her father's death from the treetops in Kenya and became queen, British colonial authorities in Kenya suppressed a rebellion against the colonial regime as a Mau Mau, which led to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps and torture. rape and killing of tens of thousands of people. Cornell University professor Mukoma Wa Negui decried the theater surrounding the Queen's death. Carnegie Mellon University associate professor Ujuya Ania posted a since-deleted tweet saying, "May her pain be excruciating," of the Queen, whom she described as the chief monarch of a thieving and raping genocidal empire. Twitter deleted Ania's initial post for violating the company's rules, and the university condemned the action in a statement. The New York Times explains more about the story, saying Queen Elizabeth II reignited a different sort of conversation, one that touched on the legacy of the British Empire and the brutality of the monarchy meted out to people in its former colonies. In a younger generation of Africans growing up in a post-colonial world, some lamented that the Queen never faced up to the grim aftermath of colonialism and empire, or issued an official apology. They said they wanted to use the moment to recall the oppression and horrors their parents and grandparents endured in the name of the crown, and to urge for the return of crown jewels, rare massive diamonds taken from the continent. Economic Freedom Fighters, a South African political party, said in a statement that it would not mourn the Queen, because to us her death is a reminder of a very tragic period in this country and Africa's history. They wrote the Queen was the head of an institution built up, sustained, and living off a brutal legacy of dehumanization of millions of people across the world. For 27-year-old Naledi Mishishi, whose South African grandmother was forced to sing the God Save the Queen anthem each day at school, Queen Elizabeth will forever remain the face of the empire and its bitter legacy in Africa. In the wake of the Queen's death, Mashishi joined a legion of young South Africans demanding the return of the diamonds that form part of the crown jewels. Cut from Cullinan, which was discovered in South Africa in 1905 and considered the largest diamond ever found, the rare gemstones sit atop the imperial state crown and the sovereign scepter, which are both used during the coronation of the British monarch. In recent years, Queen Elizabeth II, the longest-serving monarch, and the royal family have been forced to confront its colonialist past under public pressure and accusations of racism within the family. Melissa Murray, a law professor at New York University whose family is from Jamaica, tweeted that the Queen's death would accelerate debates about colonialism, reparations, and the future of the Commonwealth.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
When I said there were people who stood up firmly against arrows and swords, but they were struck down when it came to suspicions and doubts, worldly greed is somewhat involved in this. This should also be taken into consideration. What world or dunya do we mean? Each person's world or dunya is different. One person's dunya is their wealth. Someone else's dunya is their position. Another person's dunya is their lusts. Different people have different worlds, dunyas, and these are all considered to be worldly desires. People may try to justify these desires, but they are still worldly greed. These also play a part. So, as I said, the Friday prayer sermons should be fundamental and focused on presenting rich content and strong logic concerning the essential issues of the revolution, such as justice. Justice is a very important issue. Think about it, work on it, speak about it. Also speak about independence. Independence is a very important matter. The issues of supporting the underprivileged and uniting the world of Islam are also very significant issues. Give people awareness and insight.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These things that I have mentioned are also true for the upcoming Muharram sermons, and you should be able to see the results in the following Friday prayers. So, if what you're doing is successful, you should be able to see it in the people coming to the Friday prayers. If you notice that what you're doing was not effective in attracting a larger audience, there is something wrong with what you're doing. Find those flaws and fix them. We cannot say the reason for this lack of attention is that people have lost their beliefs and have become less religious. Some people say such things. It truly seems they are talking without having thought about what they're saying and are suggesting that the people have become less religious. No, that's not the case at all. They're not less religious. Just look at the Ghadir celebrations and the massive gatherings for the ceremonies and speeches during the months of Muharram and Safar. Who are the people who attend these ceremonies? They are our people. Look at the morning ceremonies, the religious ceremonies, the Arba'een Wuk. Who are these people? These are our people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people.
As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have